Welcome to The Daily Direct, an official podcast of the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel and an outgrowth of Crossing the Divide, a multimedia exploration of life in the Inner Mountain West. The Daily Direct is an in-depth monthly feature on topics ranging from modern media to local and national affairs, developed behind the scenes at the Daily Sentinel alongside journalists and decision makers delivering local headlines while navigating the shift to a digital news age. I'm Gretchen Reist, Director of Audience Engagement at the Daily Sentinel and your host for the Daily Direct. From his humble beginnings as a precocious teen in Middle America, working for a startup internet access company, to forging a groundbreaking online sales platform for music legend Prince, and later working in tech support, Curtis Minder was no stranger to the inner workings of a burgeoning online universe when a job as a systems administrator introduced him to the earliest form of internet threat actors, largely innocuous, ego-driven out to prove a superior intellect, but a predilection for the cat and mouse game of hunting down bad guys and an empathetic soul led him to where he is today, the world's most renowned ransomware negotiator who travels the globe spreading the gospel of internet security.
Well, Curtis, welcome to the Daily Direct. You are a world-renowned ransomware negotiator, and we will get into what exactly all of that means. I do have a fear that this conversation is going to revert me back to my Luddite days, because I used to be quite the Luddite. I rejected all things technical.
I'm probably happy to help you do that, actually.
Oh, I bet you would be.
You should run away. Throw your phone in the trash.
Yes. I think that might be where we end up here today. But you are now in Grand Junction here with us. But I want to go back to your origin story. So let's get you from your college days, post-college days, to here in Grand Junction. So reading a little bit, they had a great piece in the New Yorker that profiled you about the work that you do. You grew up in Illinois, correct? And your father worked at a mill, and I gathered that he was kind of more like manual labor type,
right?
Blue collar, and your mom worked for the state. But the one thing that you said that was really funny was that you didn't know what your mom did, but you liked her typing. And you said, I don't know what she's doing, but I really want to, whatever I do has to involve typing and keyboards.
It was primarily, it wasn't the typing as much as the climate controlled environment and the coffee that she was drinking. And my dad wasn't doing any of that. You know, he was lifting 50 pound sacks of flour from conveyor belts. And so I was like, I should learn how to type.
Yeah. So that took you into the white collar world. I had something a little similar with a paper mill that I worked in for 3 summers on maintenance. And that was actually the idea of the program, was do well in school because you don't want to do this for your entire life.
Builds character.
It did. Let me tell you, that's going to make it into my newsletters one of these days. Okay, so you went to school, you got out of school and you were working tech support, and then you eventually went into, you were a systems administrator, and this is like back in the 90s.
Yeah.
But at that time, you started to notice that there were some patterns that you were seeing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I mean, there were threat actors, as we call them. We don't call them hackers necessarily in the industry. We call them threat actors. The threat actors were active back then too. They were just a different kind, for the most part. There were usually young people who were trying to prove how smart they were. It was more of a ego driven operation than anything else. Not like profit like it is today. And we would see weird activity in the logs of the systems that we were administering. And I, you know, I became sort of obsessed with this idea that we could track these people down and maybe mitigate some of those threats. And at the same time, a book came out by a guy named Clifford Stoll. It's called The Cuckoo's Egg. It's a true story about he worked in, I think, Berkeley National Labs, and he discovered this in the logs. And the story is about him chasing down these international criminals who had broken into the national labs. And that book had come out at the same time that I'm sitting in front of these router logs. It was fascinating to me. And so I got hooked with sort of chasing bad guys for a living.
So that was kind of the early days. You said they weren't really too threatening. As you said, they're just kind of trying to outsmart people. And you kind of got into that too. You said, I like the cat and mouse and I have to try and outsmart these people. But let's talk about, or at least give an overview of how we got to where we are today, which is where the ransomware hacking is kind of the primary thing that you're dealing with. So can you take us kind of through that evolution from those early days in the 90s? And then you've got Bitcoin that comes into play and that sort of changes things a little bit. So can you kind of take us through what the evolution of this is?
Yeah, I think, you know, just cybercrime in general has evolved with the evolution of technology and connectivity. Ransomware specifically, which is a form of cybercrime where the bad guys basically break into your computer systems, they steal a bunch of your data first, and then they lock those systems using a type of encryption that you have to pay them to unlock. So they make your computers useless. There's been a version of that dating back to the 80s. And it just wasn't as scalable. So the bad guys would, for example, send a disk, a floppy disk, remember those, to a particular person, and they would put the disk in the drive, and the disk would automatically do these bad things where it would lock their computer and then pop up a screen and say, you know, send a money order to Panama for this amount and I'll give you the code to unlock your computer, right? Well, that really sucked for that person, but that was it. That was, you know, that one person was impacted, that one computer was impacted. And as time went on, computers become more and more connected. It became easier for those bad guys to impact multiple machines because they're connected. What really precipitated it or accelerated the problem was a couple of things. One, you mentioned the advent and sort of adoption of cryptocurrency, which now allows the threat actors to send seemingly like unlimited amounts of capital overseas, untracked and sort of unmonitored, in an anonymous fashion. Around the same time, you had sort of the adoption, the broader adoption of what is now called the dark web, which is a real thing. And so the dark web similarly has an anonymous component so that folks can then trade and sell data and things like that without being traced or tracked.
How do you access the dark? I mean, where do you...
You're going the wrong direction. You were going to throw your phone away a minute ago, and now you're asking me how to connect to the dark web.
Well, no.
I'm just kidding. So I'll just give you some history. The dark web is a general term for networks... computer networks that are not accessible by normal internet means. There's several different kinds of dark web networks. Mm. The one that is most common and most, when you hear people refer to dark web generally, they're talking about what they call Tor. Have you ever heard that? Tor is an acronym. It stands for the Onion Router. And it's the idea of peeling back layers of an onion, kind of is the concept behind it. That was actually invented by the US government for actual legitimate purposes. Primarily in the early days, it was to get communications between, for example, the U.S. government and dissidents in a country that had a high level of sort of filtering for outside communication, where they would block certain kinds of communication. That was the real purpose. But like everything that we make, it's also used for evil. Mm-hmm. And you could say that about the internet itself, right?
Everything.
Everything gets used for evil eventually. And the dark web is not entirely... you know, bad. There, actually, one of my staff runs a church in the dark web.
Oh, okay.
Right. So that you can do legitimate things, and there's actual legitimate applications for it. But there is, you know, because of the nature of how it's built and then anonymity it affords those threat actors, it's primarily used for illicit purposes. And just to give you some context, answer your question, to access Tor, which is a version of dark web, you actually just need to download a special browser called a Tor browser, and you can connect directly. It does all the work for you, and you connect. But what you, as a normal user, you can't accidentally access the dark web. You can't accidentally stumble into the dark web. That's not a thing. And the third thing that sort of precipitated the problem is the pandemic.
Yeah,
where people started requesting and getting remote access to systems, and they weren't securing those remote access systems well enough. And it was an opportunity for the bad guys. Yep.
So you kind of, let's talk about GroupSense, which is your entity you've got in Washington, You're also overseas. Mm-hmm. So when you first started this organization, you weren't really dealing with ransomware too much. This sort of kind of fell in your lap.
Yeah.
And you had to adjust really quickly to how to even do this.
Right. Yeah. So the ransomware engagement part of our business was quite literally an accident. We were sort of pulled into that. Our core business is what we call digital risk protection services, which is basically the premise behind our core product is the bad guys or the threat actors, if you will, the access that they get to people's networks is usually precipitated. Successful cyber attacks are usually precipitated by the bad guys having access to some data that they shouldn't have access to. Mm-hmm. And our core product looks for that data surfacing in places it shouldn't be and helps companies mitigate or clean that up to reduce the risk. That's the main purpose. And how that data ends up in places, one, you know, the bad guys sometimes steal it and trade it in the dark web. That's one way. And other ways are less malicious than that. Like your employees accidentally post data someplace and they don't properly lock it down. That happens almost as frequently as the bad guy stuff. And so just having a tool that tells you when your data is surfacing in places it shouldn't be and helping you remediate that is our core product. But as part of that, we run a pretty sophisticated cyber espionage operation, which means I have people on my team around the world who all they do is make friends with bad guys. And those bad guys think they're other bad guys, and we get invited to the party, if you will. The party is sort of these underground marketplaces where they sell things, stuff like that. And we have to be in those places to look for our customers' data, right? Mm-hmm. Showing up. And as part of that, that kind of puts us in the nexus of the ransomware economy, which is these dark web forums where illicit access is sold and traded, and data is sold and traded. And it's a long series of events that put us there, but we eventually get pulled fully into this ransomware response market where we're helping companies either prepare and prevent or respond to a ransomware attack.
How educated do you think most entities, businesses, people are in terms of how to prevent this kind of stuff? And is it 100% preventable, or is it just we can mitigate it? You're never really going to be able to, I mean, it's going to happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first question, I think the bulk of companies, you know, the broader market they're not well prepared for this or not well educated on the basics. And I'm working on that. It's like a passion project of mine. And nothing's 100% preventable, but most of these attacks are opportunistic in nature. And if you do a handful of sort of basic, what I call cyber hygiene items, you can reduce the likelihood or the risk that you're going to become a victim by a lot, by doing very, very little. And so that's part of the message is, you know, just getting the message out that, hey, do some basic things and things are you're less likely to be a victim. There are certain threat actor groups and individuals who target specific entities. Mm-hmm. In that case, you're pretty much going to have to depend on a response plan because eventually they're going to get it. They have all the time and resources in the world. And typically they're targeting large companies. You're a large company and you have, we call the term attack surface. You have a very large attack surface because you're IBM or you're a large pharmaceutical or something like that. So they're eventually going to find a mistake that you made. Mm-hmm. And they only have to be right once. Mm-hmm. So they will eventually get in. So having a plan to respond and remediate is a key part of their strategy.
So you're dealing directly with these people. You know, this is, you start out and you're really more tech oriented. This is now negotiation.
Yeah.
So this is more psychology. So I'm wondering if you could talk to how you approach these negotiations and also how equipped was your own labor force, your own workforce to deal with this sort of new realm? Because I don't think most people think of techies as really being the high EQ scale type of people, right? This is not what they're trained to do.
Yeah, that's actually very true. And it's funny, when we first got pulled into this, first by a victim and then later by cyber insurance companies and law firms asking us to help with these things, I was under the impression that the traditional technical incident, what they call incident response firms, these are the people that parachute in when you have a cyber attack and help you clean that up and kick the bad guys out and lock the doors and they give you a report at the end to say, this is what happened. I was under the impression that they were the ones handling these kinds of cases from a what I would call a threat actor engagement, talking to the bad guys, right? Turns out your point is pertinent, because they're all very technical, and it is a soft skill, and there weren't very many folks out there when we first started doing this that were doing it very well, if they were doing it at all. And we had some advantages when we started out, in that, you know, my team has a fair number of former law enforcement folks who had done undercover work and had been trained in negotiation. I think there's, you know, I happen to get lucky and have some of those soft skills, a tremendous amount of empathy. I want to make sure you understand, I don't have sympathy necessarily, but empathy, they're right. Different. I can understand where the threat actors are coming from. Mm-hmm. And that has a lot to do with our background. It's, you know, we're being in the computer hacker space, and everybody sort of comes from that. And we understand sort of how the underground works. Plus, we talk to these bad guys every day, right?
Yeah.
In our day job, we're talking to the bad guys every day. We kind of know the economy that they're working in and how they're motivated. And so that gave us an advantage. And then over time, we partnered with, you know, the Harvard Negotiation Project. We had FBI former hostage negotiators reach out and collaborate with us. And so we end up building a framework that made this sort of repeatable. Mm. But it is still difficult to train for. It is very difficult. It really, the person either has to have these sort of soft skills already, or, you know, something similar. Just taking one of my software engineers, it's not going to work, right? Like, they're not going to be able to do that.
Yeah. So are you able to, can you kind of describe the personality type that you're dealing with? Because I'm sure that people drawn into this quote unquote line of work, which it kind of is, and we will talk about that. It's like syndicates, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a business in and of itself. Because I always have this idea that a lot of these people are just a bunch of neckbeards running international crime syndicates from their mother's basements. Like, is that, I mean, who are these people?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what the Russian government wants you to think. Mm. That's their plausible deniability. Mm. But no, you're right. Most of these, are organizations run much like a business. There are junior and middle level management and, department heads. They have quotas, they have, you know, salaries, they have bonuses, they have president's club. If they have all of the things that you would expect a business to have. And so the personalities vary from organization to organization. You know, when you first engage with these folks, you're not usually having a conversation, because the person that you're engaging with is very junior in the organization.
Yeah.
They're normally pasting a script or something. They probably don't even speak English, right? Mm. And then as you move up the organization, you get the proficient English speakers, or more proficient English speakers, and you get into more of a dialogue. I will say that, you know, because of the fact that in most cases, their home countries, primarily Russia and or Russian influenced Eastern European countries, have afforded them some unofficial amnesty for what they're doing. Mm. They're pretty bold. Mm. They can be real, you know, really sort of egotistical and forceful in their language. So our engagement has always been, we have a few, you know, tenets that we operate by, which is like, we are to the best of our ability, never antagonistic. We're slightly deferent, but not weak. Mm-hmm. We use very plain English. We don't use big words, because we understand that they might be pasting this into Google Translate, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't know how that's going to come out the other side from a tone and context perspective. Mm-hmm. We have a whole you know, set of tools on how we guide these negotiations, but you know, one of our goals is to try to avoid using deception as part of the strategy, which is hard because the bad guys have a lot of leverage, and you have to create false leverage somehow, and deception would be a way to do that. Unfortunately, you know, the leverage that they do have is they have a tremendous amount of your data and information, and it's really hard for you to be dishonest if they look at that data. So you can't lie about how much money that you have in the bank if they have a copy of your finances.
Yeah.
And they often do. Mm-hmm. And so in order to remain credible in those ransomware discussions, and negotiate, like we like to say, negotiate in good faith, we try to be honest. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds bizarre, but it actually ends up working out pretty well for us.
I'm curious, is this a male-dominated thing?
When I say bad guys, you mean like generally?
Just general. I mean, that was actually one of my questions I had formulated here. Is this, you know, is this male-dominated? Because that's how I always think of it, but maybe it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's the cybersecurity industry in general, and that includes the bad persons, I guess I should say, if I'm going to be fair about it, are primarily males. However, some of the biggest attacks we've heard about were precipitated by women too. So like the Capital One hack was a lady, right? So it's a mix. And in cybersecurity, there's a big push for bringing more women into the field. And there's a lot of champions for that.
So in reading up on this, the little bit that I did, the FBI has played somewhat of a role in this, but it seemed to me that they were more taking the tact of don't negotiate with these people. You're just incentivizing this. So what would you say to those who would claim that the work that you do in negotiating these deals not only incentivizes the practice, but makes you aiders and abettors to the crime?
Yeah. That's an ethical challenge. And I've actually spoken to some business schools ethics programs about this. So the challenge is that right now, most companies who get affected by this basically have two options: pay a ransom or go out of business. And so, you know, until there's a third option, I think having negotiation on the table as an option is necessary. How I balance that, like how I look myself in the mirror, is that I am a big proponent of cybersecurity hygiene. I volunteer my time all over the country speaking about this, and teaching about this, but I also spend time in Washington educating lawmakers, briefing Congress. I do work a lot with the FBI. I give the FBI and CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency, free data all the time about these threat actors. And I'm trying to influence both the policy, but also the macro view of the problem, so they understand how big it is from the policymaker perspective, by sharing all of this. And so it is a tough situation. But you know, given the fact that most of the victims are in sort of the small to medium business range, and small to medium businesses sort of make up the backbone of our economy, and there's not a lot of people helping them with this, many of them are going out of business, and people are losing their jobs, and lots of capital is being transferred overseas without my assistance. Like, they're just paying the ransom when they don't need to pay that. They can pay a smaller amount. You can even see it in the ransom notes. The ransom notes, they vary from group to group, but you'll see words in those notes like, "Let's make a deal." So when the bad guys in the very beginning of the communication are indicating to you, do not pay the sticker price, don't pay the sticker price.
Let's make it.
Right? Yeah, let's make a deal. Right.
That's interesting.
Right. Yeah.
Now, we've talked about kind of the good guys and the bad guys, quote unquote. But there is sort of this middleman where some of the people who are portraying themselves as the good guys might not actually be as good as they're making themselves out to be. Who are these entities?
There's a lot of different versions of this, and unfortunately, because of the sort of the paradigm in which we're operating, which is, you know, cryptocurrency and dark web conversations, there is a lot of room for someone to commit fraud, and so that's basically what's happening. So there, for example, if you were a victim of a ransomware attack, let's say one of the bad guys, groups names, let's say, Black Basta is one of the bad guy groups, right? So let's say you get hit by Black Basta and you go on Google and you search for how to decrypt Black Basta ransomware. The first five results are going to be paid advertisements or search results by, what they call data recovery companies. And the majority of the time, those companies will have a narrative, something like, "You don't have to pay the bad guys. You can pay us because we have special software that can decrypt the bad guy's software." And I'll just tell the listeners that that's not a real thing. That's not a thing that exists, right? So what they actually do is they will engage the threat actor without the victim's knowledge, negotiate a price for the ransom, mark it up a certain percentage, and then charge you that for their special software, which is actually just the bad guy's software to decrypt your... And there's a whole market of these guys. And there's some operating here in the U.S. right now, currently. Yeah.
So this kind of feels like layers of criminal mindset.
Yeah.
Which I guess I shouldn't say I wish I had, but it's amazing to me how people can see a situation and automatically figure out a way to capitalize on it.
Yeah.
That's not a skill I think I have. I don't know if that's good or bad, but
yeah, I envy my colleagues who are that way. They seem to run through walls and make things happen. But unfortunately, the bad guys do too, and they have the tools to do it.
So something happened recently, and I didn't delve into it enough, but it had to do with the Justice Department kind of stepping in, and they've done some things to. I think it even had to do with people like you, that if you get caught negotiating these deals, you could get into some sort of trouble. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So I think I know what you're talking about. So the Treasury Department.
Yes.
So the Treasury Department sent out a memo last year, and I was actually really disappointed with how this was worded. But basically, it was a kind of a shot over the bow to companies to say that, you know, if we find that you're paying threat actors that are on the what they call the OFAC sanctions list. So under the Treasury Department, there's the Office of Foreign Assets Control. They determine who thou shalt not transact with. Mm. And so those are sometimes whole countries like Iran and or entities within a country, which is the case for like Russia and stuff like that. So there's certain companies and or individuals you can't transact with. And so they made it sound sort of ambiguous and nefarious that you as an entity doing these engagements with threat actors or paying ransoms, that you could end up in trouble with the Treasury Department and the SEC. The fact is that OFAC sanctions list is a thing you can check. And that's part of the process is we try to determine the likelihood that money is going to end up in somebody on that list's pocket. And we have a whole bunch of ways to do that. Anything from just checking the OFAC list to actually doing crypto tracing to follow where the money goes. Mm-hmm. And also look at the wallets before we pay them to see where else that money goes. So we do a lot of stuff to check that. Yes, you can get in trouble if you pay the wrong people, but it is not in most states, there's a couple states now where it is not illegal to pay a ransom.
If I read this correctly, some of these syndicates are sort of working on image control. Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that? They're worried about their reputations now, and that there's an unspoken code now in terms of what entities we're going to attack versus what entities we will not.
Yeah, and that varies from group to group. I mean, you have groups that will say, hey, we're not going to attack, for example, hospitals or you know, critical infrastructure. And then you have groups that say, you know what, we are, everybody's fair game. So it varies from group to group. As far as like, interesting that they do seem to sort of elevate a brand. They, like I mentioned, Black Basta. There's a bunch, like Lockbits are a very big one right now. Mm. That's making a lot of noise. And they have sort of brand programs where they go into these chat rooms and they promote themselves and try to get affiliates. They have blogs where they talk about their ideals and things like that. And that's all interesting to me. The one thing that the Treasury Department thing, I think, did is it raised the awareness from the bad guy's perspective that if they are on one of these lists or they end up on one of these lists, they may not get paid. So what do they do? Just change their name. Just change their name. So they just move, like, okay, well, we're not Black Hawks anymore. We're, you know, whatever, make up a name, and they change names. And so that's why doing things like the crypto sort of intelligence and crypto tracing is important, because they can change their names, but they're going to get paid somehow. Is that money ending up in Tehran? You know, where's that money going? And so trying to figure that out in advance of a payment is critical over just checking the OFAC sanctions list, which is name based, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, how sophisticated do you have to be able to get into this? And this stems from a question I was going to ask you, which, judging by everything that you do, I know the answer to already. But having read this quote, it's way too easy to get into this. You or I could do it. Just hire it out. When I saw this, when they're saying, oh, yeah, anybody can do it, I'm thinking, wow.
Yeah, so now I have to throw your phone away. Like,
yes.
you're scaring me. So certainly, when I say it's easy, it's because it's become sort of a marketplace where if you have the technical aptitude to open a cryptocurrency wallet and put money in it, which is not terribly difficult to do, and you have the ability to get on Tor, and you know roughly where to go, that's a little bit tricky, but you can figure it out by Googling around. You can buy stolen network access. So somebody already broke into the company for you and they're just going to give you the credentials to log in. And then you can go over to what they call a ransomware as a service platform, and you can pay them to do the attack and they give you a percentage. And so it's and they'll do the negotiation and do settlement and everything, and then you get paid a percentage. And those are called affiliates. So literally, I could probably teach my mom how to do this. It's not that hard. It's really not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It almost seems like when I was reading about this, you're talking about people reading from scripts and how it's just kind of down to this science. It's almost like the fast food industry, like McDonald's. That's mm-hmm. what it made me think of immediately, where it starts off and it's just these techies, you know, with the real technical knowledge kind of doing this stuff. But then it grows and grows and grows to the point where it's like any other entity, where now it's only the people at the very top who have that technical skill. But, you know, they can be pulling people off the streets to just...
Right.
You know,
that's how they scale it. And you know, the cyber intelligence community, which, you know, our core product is a part of that community. You know, we estimate there's like in, let's say Russia, for example, there's probably 50 people who actually run all of that stuff.
Hmm.
50. That's it. And then everybody else is sort of part of the system. They hire and fire them, and they move between groups just like employees. But you know, the masterminds, if you will, there's probably, you know, 50 or so of them.
I would have to imagine, because you are very passionate about this, and you seem to have a very strong moral, ethical code, compass. Part of the frustration would be, and I think we all feel this, not just watching cyber criminals, but even criminals that work in the physical space, and thinking of the intelligence behind what has been created.
Yeah.
And how these minds could be put to good use.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, part of the empathy is understanding that and again, it's not sympathy, but understanding that these people probably live in places where their talent is going unused.
Yeah.
There's no economic opportunity. It's very difficult for them to get out of that situation for various reasons. And this is a, you know, there's no negative consequences for trying this.
Yeah.
And after they do it a couple times and they make enough money to buy a Ferrari, well, then why stop? Right.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what's, you know, sort of feeding that. And I think that feeds a lot of crime, you know, globally. It's lack of economic opportunity is the issue. But you're right. Some of the people that wrote the ransomware as a service platforms, the people that wrote the encryptor software that locks the files, that's very complex stuff.
Yeah.
They're actually very intelligent individuals.
Yeah. Right. And actually just the organizational development of all of it
as well.
There are a couple of sort of ancillary things I think about. One was a guy in Canada who had been running this big drug syndicate, went to jail and put it on his resume because he had this amazing experience. And it's all true. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's a different universe, right? But it's still the same principles. Another one that I heard, and I think I remember the origin of this. I had a chance to meet the woman who was the screenwriter for Fear and Loathing.
Wow.
Yeah, and she actually was Boulder based, and she was talking about working for the BBC, and they were doing this story on this kid in Scotland who was like 10, and he was running this drug syndicate. 10-year-old. He had 40 and 50-year-old men working for him.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
And he got caught, and they took him to jail. And if I recall this correctly, she walked down to the, you know, the police and basically said, "What are you doing? Look at this kid's, look at what this kid was doing. Look what he's capable of. If you throw him in jail, you're just going to waste that."
Yep. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's kind of the same thing of, wow, if we could put these minds to good in the world, what we could accomplish.
Yeah, I think there was like, you know, sort of in the early 2000s, maybe there was this period where if you got caught doing a cyber crime, you got a cool job. I think that's also dangerous because there has to be negative consequences for breaking the law.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how talented you are, right? And so that has shifted. People are actually getting sentenced to real, you know, criminal time for these crimes.
So out of curiosity, have you ever either attempted or successfully hired somebody from the other side? Does that ever happen?
I don't know. Not intentionally.
Yeah.
I would say that there are members of our team that I shouldn't ask. I know that what they're capable of. That and on the cyber espionage side, you know, part of those are relationship based things, and so these people, how they got those initial contacts, I do not know, and I'm not going to ask at the moment. I think they're law abiding citizens at the moment, but we have some nefarious type characters working in our cyber espionage team for sure.
Well, one thing that we didn't touch upon was how you got to Grand Junction. How did you end up here? Are you living here full time?
Well, I keep my stuff here.
Yeah. You're all over the place, right?
I still travel a lot. I live here full time. The way I got here, so I knew about Grand Junction when I was growing up because my cousins lived here when I was growing up. So I came a couple times when I was a kid. They've spread out a little bit now. Some of her are in Craig and they moved around a bit. The other way I knew about Grand Junction is I'm pretty well known in the cybersecurity community for riding my motorcycle across the country to conferences. So like there's a big hacker conference every year called DEF CON. I would ride my motorcycle from Washington, D.C. to DEF CON every year. And I would camp along the way. And occasionally that route would take me through Grand Junction. The main reason that got me here is my co-founder, one of my business partners in GroupSense, his mom owned Sunshine Rides.
Hmm.
And he now runs it. She's passed away. Oh. He now runs it. There's local people who operate it for him, but he's the owner of it. He lives in Miami, but he had bought a property here that he planned to move into when his youngest graduated from high school. And I just, when I learned that he had done that, I said, I will rent it from you now because I would like to get out of Washington, D.C. And so, and that was kind of at the beginning of COVID, and I love it. I love it here. Yeah.
I would be curious to know how your work impacts you emotionally. You know, because any of these people who, you know what's out there, if you have to spend any time on the dark web, and as you said, it's not all bad, but there's a lot of really bad stuff out there. So you know what's going on, you are dealing with what you're dealing with. How does that affect you emotionally? I mean, how do you balance that with maintaining a sense of decency and humanity? I mean, how does that affect your view of humanity?
Yeah, that's a really poignant question. First I'll say my team has it way worse than I do.
Yeah.
So my analyst team, that's the team that actually analyzes the data that we've collected, related to customer stuff. They see literally the worst of humanity every day. And I don't know how they do it. We do have like mental health programs as part of our benefits that we encourage them to partake in. The espionage team, same. I mean, they're basically, it's like being an undercover cop. They're just dealing with really bad people all the time.
Yeah.
And they have to basically be okay with that because they're pretending to also be bad guys. Mm-hmm. So that's also mentally straining. But yeah, the volume of good things that I see coming out of this particular discipline is very small. And it does sometimes seem hopeless, especially when the victims, when it is avoidable and they're not even taking the basic steps, and then you got to watch them suffer for it. And, you know, you have to tell them the why over and over again, why they need to do these things, and not be punitive, even though you know what's going to happen if they don't do it. And it is difficult. And on the ransomware response side, actually the dealing with the threat actors is sort of intellectually stimulating. It's a form of psychology. It's a little bit of a chess game.
Mm.
I like that part. Usually, although they frustrate me occasionally when they're unreasonable, the harder part is the victim, especially in the small business side. But in general, the victims, you're actually playing the role almost of a therapist in some cases for these victims. And I've actually, even cyber attacks that I was not involved in the response for, I have volunteered to different organizations to reach out to the people who were the sort of the management team of the company and talk to them because they're being punitive to themselves.
Mm.
And my premise is that, look, it's really unreasonable for us to expect the average person as an individual or small business owner to understand and mitigate the risks associated with their technology adoption, because technology is changing so fast that you know, these people are not tech people. I don't know how my iPhone works. Like I've been in tech for 25 years. I don't know how that thing works. So, you know, to expect, you know, the small business owner to understand how their payments platform works or that SaaS tool that they license works or is unreasonable. And one of the things that just came out in the White House cybersecurity strategy document that I liked, there's a lot of things I didn't like about that document, but one of the things I did like is that they're indicating that they're going to try to start holding software development houses responsible for these vulnerabilities. Mm. And there are parallels to this. You know, if you buy a car and that car is built incorrectly and crashes, they don't hold you responsible for that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you license a piece of software and the same thing happens, they do. You're the bad guy because you didn't take the necessary steps to mitigate the risk associated with the poor software that you just bought, the poorly designed software that you just bought. And so I think that's a huge step forward if they can find a way to actually implement and enforce that.
What would you leave listeners with? I mean, who is at risk here? Is anybody out there at risk for this? And what would you advise?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, you always want to leave on a good note, but this is not necessarily it. So first of all, we talk primarily about ransomware. Every business that is connected to the internet is a candidate for ransomware. But there's also different kinds of cyber attacks that are affecting us. And that's business email compromise.
Mm.
There are a ton of scams affecting individuals, especially older individuals, elderly individuals around the U.S., crypto scams, things like that. So yes, we're all potentially a target for these things. One, I would challenge everyone, because you got to give people a why. I argue that the basic cyber knowledge and cyber hygiene, not really complicated stuff, the basic things, is a form of civic duty and a form of patriotism, because our opponents are not from here. Mm-hmm. They're from sometimes enemy countries or unfriendly countries. They're attacking us individually. They're attacking our economy. They're attacking our businesses. People are losing their jobs. Money's getting transferred over there. I don't know what they do with the money. I don't want to know. But usually they buy stupid things like Lamborghinis and show off in the nightclubs. But you know, they, I don't know where that money goes. And so we want to give them as little as possible. And there are basic things that every individual can do that are not complicated, technically complicated. They usually don't involve spending money to reduce that for not just for themselves, but for everyone. It's the collective problem, right? Mm-hmm. And so that, I think that's what I'd like to leave people with. And, you know, we can make that available for download or something. I have a document that basically explains what these things are. And I do a lot of talks on this.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, before we let him go, how about a couple of more interesting cases, like war stories?
Okay.
Like what are some things that you've encountered that, you know, made your job drop?
Well, so many. I mean, I have some from this morning. Like, okay. Here's a very recent case. We were pulled into a case recently where it was a county government. I think I told you about this one. And the threat actors. So one of the things that the bad guys do that people don't realize is, you know, we're sort of focused on they lock the files, but what they do first is they'll gain access to your system and they will sit there. We call it, advanced persistence. So they will sit there and they'll sort of look around your network for a long time. And sometimes that period could last a year or more and you don't know they're there. What they're looking for is they're looking for information. They want to know where your data is. They want to know your financials. They would like a copy of your cyber insurance company because they know what policy, because they'll know what the payout is. They want to know who's the manager, who's the CEO, who are you transacting with. They want to get all of that information, but they also want to know, how do you do your backups? Right? Mm-hmm. And they want to mitigate that. They want to remove that. They want to make it so your backups are no longer effective and you don't know that. And they want to get their malware, the software that's going to lock things, in as many systems as possible. And what happened in this particular case is they'd been in there over a year, and they had gotten access to literally everything that had an operating system on it, including the HVAC systems, the thermostats. And when they locked it, they shut all that off. And sure, the county office buildings just don't go in, right? Because the HVAC doesn't work. But what about the jails?
Mm.
So they couldn't climate control their jails. And so they're sending buses and taking prisoners out of jail and moving people. It became very kinetic, very fast. And then as part of the data that they had taken, and the bad guys were getting really good at this, They had taken criminal justice data that included things like you know, informants and undercover police and things like that. So that data does not need to be leaked. That's bad. Yeah. You know, when we get involved in cases like that, usually federal law enforcement's very interested, and that's super, super, super high stakes to make sure that we get this resolved quickly and nobody gets hurt. And so when you add those kinetic elements, it gets very intense.
Mm.
Yeah.
So how did that resolve?
I can't say really. I can't really say.
Hypothetically.
Hypothetically, we actually came to a resolution and made a payment to the bad guys. Yeah.
So maybe you use this, maybe you don't.
Or, yeah.
Anything else, Curtis? Like just from a listener interest standpoint that you've encountered over the years.
I mean, so it, just having visibility to all the stuff that goes on in the dark web. I think maybe just zooming out for a minute and explaining how that place functions is interesting, because if you go to a dark web marketplace where they're selling illicit goods, it is as sophisticated as Amazon or eBay.
Hmm.
It looks like Amazon or eBay. So you can get on there and like search for, I would like a bazooka. And there are people selling shoulder fired rocket systems or whatever. And, they have rankings. People give them feedback. So, you know, like, oh, this guy sold 50 of these and 50 people said thumbs up. They got their rockets, right? And so it's very sophisticated. The software, the platforms themselves look a lot like the stuff you'd see on the clear web. And it makes it extremely easy to find and procure these things. And it's anything from like weapons to chemicals to illicit drugs. And then, of course, where we operate a lot is around, you know, sort of stolen information or data. That's kind of how this operates. And it's gotten so, like I said, we've gotten so easy that it doesn't take much for someone to take advantage of it or break the law, you know.
What's the easiest case you've ever had to handle?
Ransomware response case?
Right.
I don't know. So they're all kind of similar in nature with how the bad guys operate. There was one, I remember they got solved fairly quickly. It was frustrating. So this is another interesting thing to recognize about the way these organizations operate. They have a cost of goods sold. Like if you operate a business, you got margins and they have that. And so, for example, if they bought that access from what they call an initial access broker, so they didn't actually hack in themselves, they bought it. They paid somebody. That's cost of goods, right? They need to they need to make that money back. How much time did they spend exfiltrating the data, right? How much did the platform cost for them to build that software, and then they sort of amortize it across the other customers? And they actually have calculated this in a lot of cases. And there's a minimum amount of money that they will take in any case. So one particular case, they had attacked a cancer charity. And I remember, because I wasn't leading that case, one of my colleagues was, and he's a former law enforcement guy, and he usually keeps his cool. But in this case, you know, he said, what are you doing to these bad guys? This is a cancer charity. It's a non-for-profit. Almost 100% of the funds go to like preventing cancer. what are you doing? And the bad guy's response was, well, you know, how much do you think we, you know, it's worth? You know, how little should we accept? And my colleague goes, $0 is how much you should accept, and give us the keys and unlock the files. And they said, well, we can't do that, but we can do it for $5,000. And they were asking for $1,000,000. So we got them down to their cogs. Like, we're like, okay, they're not going to accept less than $5,000. They probably paid some dude $5,000 for that access, right? So they need their $5,000 back. So we were able to get that done. But that was a relatively easy case. It surprised me that they went for that, but they did.
Hmm.
You know, you told me about a case once where you recognized the threat actor.
Well, no, it actually, that case was where I recognized there was another security researcher who was in the same forums as us, and I recognized him. It's complicated how I did. And I was talking to him in person, and I said, hey, do you recognize this name? And and it was one of his handles. it's a small community. Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's like, You're kind of straddling parallel universes in a way.
That's what I found so interesting about all this. It is a universe that we don't see, we don't know about, but it's there. It's very real, and it's just going to grow.
Yeah. I say this is a little bit derogatory, but I say, like, when you shine a light, the roaches will run. So, like, when the bad guys figure out that people are watching them, they move to other places.
Yeah.
And they move around. And there's just an endless number of, you know, sort of anonymous platforms in which they can do this.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah. There's always going to be something.
And so that's why we have the cyber espionage team, because we have to know when they move. And we have to know where they go. And we have to be invited to that place sometimes, right? You have to be invited in. And so we have to chase them. Mm.
Okay. Well, that's all the interrupting I'm going to do.
Well, Curtis, thank you so much for being here today and telling your story and educating us all as to this problem. And best of luck to you in your work in trying to combat this. It sounds like an uphill battle.
It's definitely a labor of love. But yeah, thank you for having me.
That ends another edition of The Daily Direct. Thanks for tuning in. As always, you can access our full lineup of conversations with the people behind the headlines by visiting our podcasts page at gjsentinel.com or by searching Crossing the Divide on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and Amazon Music and Audible. To stay up to date on the latest headlines, visit gjsentinel.com and hit subscribe to keep the legacy of local journalism alive.